From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Amos Giora's grandfather was murdered in Auschwitz. His parents survived the Holocaust, but they both had harrowing experiences. His father made a death march to a labor camp. When he shared these stories with a friend once, she offered a reflexive question: how the hell did this happen? And Giora says that's the question. Not how could the Nazis be so evil, but how is it that bystanders just watched it all happening and did nothing? Giora is a legal scholar at the University of Utah, and he's been researching the question, and he's come to a kind of remarkable conclusion: that bystanders have an obligation to act. Not a moral obligation, a legal one. In fact, he says those who don't do something, they should be charged with a crime. Amos Giora is joining us today to make his case after the news.
Hey there, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. If you enjoy the show, we'd appreciate it if you did us a little favor. Find us on the iTunes store and leave us a review. Let us know what you think. It's valuable feedback for us, and frankly, the more reviews we have, the more listeners we can attract. Thanks in advance. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
This is Radio Westenberg Fabrizio. Most of us have stories where we saw something bad happening and looked the other way. In his new book, the scholar Amos Giora confesses to at least two of these experiences where he was faced with a decision to intervene on behalf of a vulnerable victim, or at least say something, and he didn't do anything. Now, he could justify it. Most bystanders can. It was too dangerous to intervene, or maybe it was just the natural instinct for self-protection kicking in. But Giora says that's not good enough. As we'll hear shortly, he has deeply personal reasons for exploring this issue, but he's come to a kind of remarkable conclusion: that the bystander who fails to do something is complicit, is an accomplice in some ways, and that they have a duty, not a moral duty, but a legal obligation. And if they don't act, they should be charged with a crime. This is one of the questions at the heart of a symposium which is going on at the University of Utah College of Law on Friday. And Amos Giora is joining us today to talk about all of this. He has a new book that we'll discuss. It's called The Crime of Complicity, The Bystander in the Holocaust. Amos Giora is a professor at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah, lieutenant colonel retired in the Israeli Defense Forces. He's joining us here in the studio. And, Professor, welcome. Thanks for
being here. As always, it's a great pleasure to be here.
I want to begin by asking you, have you always thought about this question? Has this always been in the back of your mind? I mean, I know this goes way back, and we'll get to a story that played out in your life when you were only five. But did you set that aside for a time, or has it always been there, this question?
The question of the bystander has been, consciously or unconsciously, a part of who I am ever since I was 5 or 6 years old, when my cousin drowned, when I was swimming with him. And I've always felt, replayed that unimaginable family tragedy in my mind. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say, literally daily.
Yeah, really,
totally. But the question of the complicity of the bystander became for me a burning question when it was my father who died a year and a half ago, when he became ill at the age of 86, and I realized that I knew literally nothing about my parents' Holocaust experiences. Mm-hmm. And from that moment on, the question of the bystander became for me, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say, an obsession.
Why do you figure? Was it just the personal connection to it? And did that then in some way merge with this thing that was in the back of your mind you were five?
The trigger, without a doubt, is when I was training for the Salt Lake City Marathon 5 years ago. My running partner, we were just, when you run mile after mile after mile, you have to kill the miles.
Yeah, and talk.
Yeah. And she said to me, how the hell did all this happen?
Yeah.
And I said, well, I don't know. And then when I started looking into it, I realized two things. One, that I knew literally nothing about my parents' Holocaust experiences. And two, even though I am the only child of two Holocaust survivors, I knew embarrassingly, very little about the Holocaust. So I began reading and reading, and the more you read, the more you read, and the more you question, the more you question. But there's, I think if I trace back the history of the book, right, it's clearly that moment when we were running when she said to me, how the hell did all this happen? And then as I started reading about the Holocaust, I very quickly found that focusing on the person or persons who watched my parents in travail interested me far more than the Nazi perpetrators and or their collaborators. I mean, the perpetrators, others have written about the perpetrators, and they don't really interest me, whether it's Hitler or, you know, Himmler or Heydrich and the rest of them. For me, it's the common person, you or me, who sees another person in distress. And then the more you start researching and the more you start thinking about it, you also go back in your own life. I mean, in addition to the unimaginable family tragedy, the two or three times where I had the opportunity to act on behalf of a vulnerable victim, I think it's two or three times where I don't know if I would say I turned my back, but I clearly didn't offer assistance, as compared to one time when I did offer help. But the time that I offered help doesn't really interest me, except in the context of why didn't everybody else who was watching this woman in terrible distress, why didn't they do something?
Yeah.
But for me, it was first of all trying to understand why, when I saw this homeless person being assaulted by a college student in Ann Arbor, I just walked away.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, in retrospect, that bothered me enormously.
So let's talk about, I want to break some of this down. When your running partner said, how the hell did this happen? As you say, it wasn't about how could the Nazis be so cruel or how is it that they came to hate the Jews so badly? What interested her and what interests you is about the individual.
Exactly right.
So
that's exactly right.
But are you thinking individual or society with a collection of individuals?
No,
do you know, is it a collective thing or just one person?
I think when she asked me the question, I can't tell you that, I immediately said, it's that one person.
Of course, yeah.
But over the course of the 4 years that it took me to research and write the book, it became clear to me that what is of interest to me is the relationship, the physicality between the vulnerable victim and that one individual who can offer assistance and in the overwhelming majority of cases makes a decision not to. I mean, it's important to add that the bystander who chooses not to act has made a decision. I mean, it's a decision.
Yeah.
And that, over the course of the 4 years, that clearly became the focus of the book.
Now, we'll come back to this because you actually break it down in the book. But to the question of, look, and your father, I think your father pushed back on you on this
totally.
Issue a lot, right? And one of the things he would say, and I guess this may have been even a refrain, or certainly there was one story you tell about where he said, in particular about the Holocaust, you can't understand, you weren't there.
That's right.
How do you deal with that question? That it's one thing for Amos Giar now in the 21st century to look back and say, these people should have done something, or there should have been, they should have been held to account, or, I mean, how do you deal with that particular question?
It's a great question. So my father, who was a clinical psychologist, who died while I was writing the book, which is also part of the story. I mean, there's so many stories within stories here. Both he and my mom very much pushed back on the issue of bystander responsibility. My father articulated by saying that for the bystander, my father on his death march and then on the escape was a Jew, and that the bystander felt that he owed no duty to that Jew who was the other.
Yeah.
And you're right. Both my parents very
much. We'll come back to that, by the way. I want to kind of dig in on that.
But you're right. My parents very much push back on the notion of the bystander, not because they're sympathetic to the bystander, because they think that the bystander didn't owe them a duty. In terms of not understanding the times, it's a really interesting question. It's always complex. Do you put yourself in historically in the shoes of the actor 75 years ago? One has to be careful with that. One has to be careful to be judgmental, if you will.
Yeah.
But I think for me, at the end of the day, I've come to the conclusion that to rigorously and critically examine the actions to intervene or not to intervene are something that I think needs to be done, with the caveats that you're right, neither you nor I were there, fortunately. But I think it is important to draw lessons from history, with the caveats that drawing lessons from history is always complex.
Yeah. It's interesting you say that it's misbegotten. It's a bad idea to rely just on moral codes. Now, I can't think of, is this your training as a lawyer that's saying this? That forget morality. I don't know how to deal with morality. It's too abstract. I can deal with legal terms. I can is that part of this, do you think?
Interesting. Well, you know, first of all, lawyers are moral, but
no, of course. But they don't think in philosophical. Well, maybe they do, and that's completely unfair. I guess what I'm saying is the laws may be more tangible.
The number one lesson for me of the Holocaust is that relying on people to do the good thing, the right thing, is a non-starter. And that's what led me to transition from a moral argument or an ethical argument to looking at this solely through the lens of the law, because I've come to the conclusion that this parable that you and I will know we can do the right thing, we can trust each other to do the right thing, for me, it doesn't work.
We'll break this down a little bit later in the program, but I want you to just at least say what the idea is. You're proposing a piece of legislation, or at least one piece of legislation, laws imposed in society that make it a legal obligation to act.
And hence the title of the book, The Crime of Complicity. Yeah. The idea indeed is to push for legislation that imposes a legal duty on the bystander to act. The duty, I'm not sure this is a good word, is mitigated by in contemporary society. All of us have cell phones, iPhones. It's relatively easy to call or dial or push for a first responder. And for me, the bystander who does that, that would meet the obligation as I define the obligation. There's no obligation to physically intervene because there's always, you know, there's the risk and who actually started the issue, the incident. Yeah. For me, calling on first responders or alerting the police, that for me is sufficient.
There's a social contract.
Absolutely.
Implied in totally. All of this. Lay that out, if you would.
So the traditional social contract is between the state and the individual. What I'm suggesting is a rearticulation of, indeed, still between state and individual, but also here between person to person. And for me, it's that person who's in a position to help or provide assistance to the vulnerable individual. For me, what is the key relationship? And we can view this as a triangle between perpetrator, vulnerable individual,
bystander.
Yeah. The perpetrator is not of interest to me. It's the relationship between the bystander and the victim. And what in terms of the social contract, I do believe that the bystander owes a duty to the vulnerable victim. That's the point.
How do you define bystander?
Somebody who's standing physically is right there and is in a position to see physically he's there, or he or she is there and is in a position to make that phone call. I've been asked repeatedly, if you and I are watching TV and we see a war crime in Aleppo, in Syria, are we bystanders to that? And I know that that theory is out there.
Yeah.
That doesn't work for me in the context of imposing legal liability on the bystander who's physically at an incident, has the capability to, again, alert the first responders, the police. So there has to be, for me, physical presence of the bystander, not some 6,000 miles away, 9,000 miles away. It's right there on the street corner of, you know, 21st and 7th in Salt Lake City.
It's, what's interesting about that idea of proximity is not just that they have the practical ability, being right there, to do something, but you write about space, mm-hmm. that there's some practical space here, but there's also emotional space.
Yeah, it's very interesting. While writing the book, and I was very fortunate that my research is grant-supported, which enabled me to travel to Europe on a number of different occasions. When I was in Berlin, there's the train platform, the quote-unquote iconic train platform from where Berlin's Jews were deported. And when I got to – the train platform has been turned into a very stark memorial. There are pictures of it in the book. Platform and rocks. Why rocks? Because in Judaism, I don't know if you know this, but in Judaism we place rocks on graves, right? That's all that's there. But then in, I don't know, 50 feet away from the platform are two houses. And I became –
Old houses. Yeah, at least
exactly.
75 years
that's
old, right?
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
I've been to the platform twice, and I've walked around here. And you walk. It's hard to walk around there because it's closed off. I probably was trespassing, but that's okay in the name of research.
Right.
I became, again, obsessed with what did the people in the upstairs bedroom see when they looked out onto the train platform? What did they see? And I try to, in the book, explain this idea of what you call proximity or physicality. What did the bystander see? What did the bystander understand? Or what did the bystander choose not to see? the same, the exact same experience in the Netherlands. When I go to Amsterdam, I have coffee, croissant and coffee, the exact same restaurant every morning. And across the street from this little cafe, there's a beautiful building. And it's not far from what was Amsterdam's Jewish neighborhood. And I really found myself asking the people in this house, if they had Jewish neighbors, what did they understand since when the Jews were being deported to Amsterdam's central train station, when they saw them walking carrying their bags? So for me, the idea of physicality proximity is what you see when I'm walking with my bag towards the train station. And that is, I think, a critical aspect of this, is that relationship between the bystander and the victim, where the bystander has the opportunity to see the victim in those moments of distress, mm-hmm. can choose to turn a blind eye, turn away, close the curtains, right? Or can decide to make, for me, is the correct decision, the lawful decision, the decision he's obligated to do, to seek assistance.
I wanted to ask you, one of the things you explain in the book is that this has been a tough sell.
Absolutely.
Look, I get that you're trying to ask the deep questions about why bystanders do act or don't act. I get that. But why do you want to hold them legally accountable? It seems like people are kind of mystified in some ways by that.
So it's very interesting that during the course of the 4 years that I worked on this, and as I say, I traveled to Europe and I gave a number of talks, works in progress, and I've met with an innumerable number of people. Many were sympathetic to the moral, right? I know what to do. My especially when I interviewed people of our age in Holland whose parents or grandparents took Jews in, right? It's very interesting, who assured me that their family, their parents or grandparents, they did the right thing. And from that I can learn that all of society did the right thing, but that's incorrect. Yeah. So you're right. There is pushback on the imposing of the legal obligation. One of the clear questions is, how do you go about actually implementing this? On whom do you impose the duty? How do you actually define complicity? But I find those questions, I understand them. I get the pushback. I have a great respect for that. But it strikes me that those are easily resolvable once we make the determination that the bystander has a legal obligation to act, and it's a prosecutable crime.
So, but what do you make of the resistance to it? Not that it's impractical, but when we go down, it seems like people are worried that if you go down this road, the implications of imposing a legal obligation on something that can be construed as a moral, ethical question, what's the logical extension of that? What are the unintended consequences potentially?
I think one of the unintended consequences, which has been articulated to me, so I guess that now makes it an intended, right?
Right.
Is that we'll become a society that reports. And I understand that. But in the terms of cost-benefit analysis, where's the greater harm or the greater good? As interesting as that argument is, it does not sway me from the primary issue here, which is to impose this duty on the bystander to act on behalf of the vulnerable victim. For me, the focus at all times is the vulnerable victim, and how does the bystander, who your word proximity, physicality, is in a position to provide assistance.
But how is – it seems like if you're using as a reference point the Holocaust – how is that? That seems like an extreme baseline, right?
You're 100% correct. And the book went through, I can't even begin to tell you how many iterations and how many drafts. I need to put in parentheses, if I may, that the book began as yet another law book looking at the extremism. Right? That's really how it began. And as I was writing it, when my father became ill, I deleted, junked that initial iteration because I found that to be not interesting. Because at the end of the day, I want to tell a story. I want to tell a story through the lens of my parents. That's what this book really is, right?
I
don't like the expression, so I apologize in advance. I use the Holocaust as a hook to get to where we are in society today. And I asked myself, what in contemporary society best articulates the consequences of bystander inaction? I asked myself, is it the refugee crisis in Europe? And I decided that I don't know enough about it to write about it, because you have to be really careful when you undertake a writing project not to write about stuff you're not really conversant in. And I came to the conclusion that in contemporary society today, it is the sexual assaults on college campuses that, unfortunately, tragically, you know, this spike in sexual assaults, and clearly the role of the bystander. And I looked into it and I researched. There are three different instances. Two are rapes on college campuses, and one is a rape murder, not on college campus, but in Las Vegas with Cash and Strohmeyer, a very famous case where Strohmeyer rapes and murders Sharice Iverson. Cash, who's his friend, looks over the bathroom stall, sees him, says to him, "Hey, dude, what are you doing?" and walks out of the bathroom. Cash has been interviewed on 60 Minutes by Ed Bradley. No remorse, no guilt, no anything. I mean, it's for me, shocking.
Yep.
And if there's a bystander who needs to be in jail, it's David Cash. And then there's the rape at Vanderbilt committed by a football player whose name is Vandenberg. He was convicted a couple of months ago. He's not interesting. What's interesting, or who is interesting for me, is his roommate, Prelo, yeah, who's also a football player. He's in the upstairs bunk, and Vandenberg wakes him up and, you know, suggests that he join, you know, quote unquote, in the party.
This woman was unconscious.
She was unconscious, and she was Vandenberg's on-off girlfriend. And Vandenberg tries to wake Prelo up, and Prelo feigns sleeping because, as he says, that he was uncomfortable, clearly in a position to provide assistance to this woman who was in terrible distress. There's no doubt about it. It's all – they videoed her. They videoed the rape.
Yeah.
For me, Prelo is somebody who absolutely falls into my category of the bystander who was there, heard, saw, should have been prosecuted, should have been convicted. Unfortunately, in the state of Tennessee, there are no laws with respect to bystander obligation. He today is, you know, living his life.
There's the third of that story takes place on the campus of Stanford.
It does.
It has a different ending.
It does.
Talk about how that fits.
Interesting. So the swimmer Brock Turner is at a party. He meets this woman, and they end up walking back to her apartment, or where she was staying. They're walking down a trail in Stanford. He's attempting to rape her, and two bicyclists from Sweden it's middle of the night, and Brock Turner and the woman are next to a dumpster. Strikes them as odd, the two bicyclists, and they say, "Hey, what are you doing?" And they see the, I apologize for the intimacy, right, that his pants are down, her pants are down. Something doesn't strike them, and so he starts running, Brock Turner does. These two guys are relentless. They catch him.
Chase him down.
They do. They chase him down.
It probably helped that he was pretty drunk.
He was pretty drunk. Yeah. He's pretty drunk, but he's also a big-time Division I athlete, right?
That's right.
So he's not like, you know, a regular old guy.
Yeah.
And they clearly are, from my perspective, two people who did the right thing. It's an interesting question that I've been asked. If they would have continued riding their bike and don't say anything. So I've spent a lot of time interviewing Stanford students about this incident. And I asked them the uncomfortable question, and I need to put in parentheses. You write a book like this, you get into all kinds of uncomfortable scenarios, obviously.
Yeah.
Was this, you know, trail, was this a quote-unquote lover's lane? Is this a place where, you know, college students would meet? The answer was no. So it was clear that this was an out-of-context type of thing. I don't know if the two of them knew that. But if they would have continued riding their bike, I don't think that they would have met my culpable bystander test, because they would have seen, I think, in the middle of the night, a couple in various stages of disrobed, next to a dumpster, and they probably could have continued on riding their bike.
You see, this gets to the – I know you deal with this question of how you measure intent.
That's exactly right. So if you take the Stanford case, if you take the Cash case and Prelo at Vanderbilt.
Yeah.
So there's no doubt that Cash, who looks over the bathroom stall and sees his friend Strohmeyer raping and murdering Sharice Iverson, there's no doubt there. I mean, that's as clear cut can be. Prelo, who sees Vandenberg and others raping her, sodomizing her, and he knows that she's unconscious. He's very open about that. He clearly was in a position to help, and he clearly chose not to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And his statement really is that I was uncomfortable. I mean, seriously.
That's not enough for you.
No, it's not at all, at all. I mean, you know, not at all. The two bicyclists get a gold star for doing the right thing. Would they be, in my test, subject to prosecution? I think probably not.
If they hadn't done anything.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, it's complicated.
It is.
Yeah. Amos Giora is with us, law professor at the University of Utah. His book is called The Crime of Complicity. This Friday from 8 until 3, there's going to be a symposium at the S.J. Quinney College of Law. It's focused on the bystander dilemma, the Holocaust, war crimes, and sexual assault. The event is free. It's open to the public. You can get information about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, this question. If you see something bad happening, could you, should you be held accountable if you don't try and stop it? University of Utah legal scholar Amos Guiara has been asking this question pretty much all of his life. His grandparents died in the Holocaust, and he wondered why so many people stood by and did nothing. So he's written a book that not only explores the moral imperatives for bystanders, he's actually more interested in the legal obligation to act. His book is called The Crime of Complicity, The Bystander in the Holocaust. He's going to be speaking as part of a symposium at the University of Utah Law School on Friday. We'll tell you a little bit more about that as we go along. I want to come back to this story you tell. We talked about this a little bit earlier. The tragedy that you say haunts you to this day, when your cousin Danny was drowned. You write this in the book, that the overwhelming magnitude of that event is more powerful than any rational analysis regarding the limits of what a small child can do. Because you would acknowledge, at least in theory, that, come on, you were only 5 years old. What were you going to do? But you say it shaped your understanding of accountability and of responsibility and of these consequences. Explain that. Explain, because so this really keyed on your brain when you were really young.
So it is truly an unimaginable family tragedy that is just that. My cousin Danny had a twin brother, David. We were living in Israel. Their mother, my aunt, abandoned them when they were small boys, and my parents would take them in every weekend to give my uncle a break. What complicates this or makes it even more tragic, everybody in the story is a Holocaust survivor. Everybody in the story is a psychologist. You can't make these things up, yeah. Right? And the book opens, the last picture taken of Danny alive is with me 24 hours before he drowns. My uncle carried that picture with him in his suit pocket coat every day for 50 years. My uncle died 50 years to the day that my cousin drowned. We went swimming in a public pool in northern Israel because it was Passover. And I was in the water with Danny, and he had a physical disability. And I said to him, you know, you can't swim, can't swim. You know, the way kids argue.
Yeah.
And I got out of the water. There's also a question of, you know, did I leave the water because my mom said, you know, we need to get out of the water and David will take – I mean, there's a whole – everybody – it's a Rashomon, right?
Yep.
But when the time came to leave the pool, you know, where's Danny? And I remember with David – they were 14. I was 5. David and I going into the locker room, right, trying to find Danny, and he wasn't there. And I don't know if – first of all, hope that – wish neither for you nor for the listeners – to be in a situation of unimaginable panic. Where's Danny? And then he tragically was found in the bottom of the pool. You know, the drive to the race to the hospital is forever, I don't know, etched in my memory. And without a doubt, it at a very early age taught me this principle, the consequences of accountability.
Yeah.
You know, did Danny drown for this reason or for that reason? At the time, there was no pathology report. There was no autopsy. But his death, his horrific death, right, and my being in the pool with him, in many ways defines who I am totally. By the way, I need to add in parentheses, if I may, when we have three kids and I – do not, I don't swim with them, and I don't. Interestingly enough, while writing the book, I actually started swimming, and I swim now 3 times a week.
Wow. One of the things you say in the book is that if we all have a natural instinct to protect ourselves, which it seems like we do, right? Then if we have that instinct, are we obligated to re-examine that instinct? Which made me wonder, how can you re-examine an instinct? How can you hold people to account for an impulse so strong? It's part of your physiology.
Yeah. So as I mentioned to you, that I could probably write a book about writing the book, right? when I was in Maastricht in southern Holland, I met with a woman who's 85 years old, exactly my mother's age, who lived across the street from a Jewish family that was deported. And she, the day of the deportation in Maastricht, her father told her to go across the street to say goodbye to her classmates. She goes to their house to, you know, part from them, and she comes back home, and she's with her in her house with her father. Her father has 5 other children. His wife had previously died. That's important to the story.
Yeah.
And she tells me that when she came back into her living room, her father closed the drapes, right? And
had 7 kids.
Right, to be responsible for, exactly, yep. Right? He closes the drapes, and she somehow looks and sees that they're getting onto the truck and off they go to Auschwitz. When I met with her in her kitchen, she said, we'll have 20 minutes for this conversation, and she's 85, so things are a little bit slow, and I'm looking at the watch. He says, you know, you want some tea? Because, you know, we in Holland always drink tea. I think, oh, man, that'll take 5 minutes to make the tea, and then I have the tea. And she said, but, you know, we in Holland don't drink tea alone. We must have cookies with our tea. I'm saying, okay, that's great. It's another 5 minutes. I got 10 minutes left. And with us is a translator, because this woman speaks no English. And, you know, when there's a simultaneous translation, that slows everything down. So I'm first question in, my 20 minutes are up. I stayed there a long time,
yeah.
And the conversation became extraordinary when she told me. It was one of those really awful conversations. When she talked about her father, she said to me, my father has always been my hero until today, because you have made me ask myself, was my father a coward? And I said to this woman, and she was crying and crying, and the translator was crying and crying. It was horrible. I said, I'm not putting words in your mouth, in no way, you know. It's up, however you define her. I'm just curious in the story. And she said that this really is going to require her to rethink how she views her father. I said, that was not in any way the intention. The story is, you know, story gathering. You know, I was one
but,
of
but, you, but that is part of what you do want, though, don't you? You want a reevaluation of some of those impulses.
I guess, you know, it's an interesting question. The answer, I'm not dodging. Maybe because you want to rearticulate paradigms or rethink paradigms.
Yeah.
Clearly, this was an uncomfortable moment. And as I'm leaving, finally leaving her modest home, she said, no, you can't leave yet. And I thought, oh, my God, right, what's next? She takes me into the kitchen, and on her kitchen wall, it's a stark house. It's a bare house. In the kitchen, there's a picture of her 2 classmates.
Wow.
That she has had on her wall for the past, you know, 5,000 years, she said, please take a picture of it. I mean, it's one of those moments, right, that I didn't intend to cause her, you know, uncomfortableness. But there is no doubt that of the people I've talked to while writing the book, right, it confronts you in many ways. Mm-hmm. I think this is one of what you're getting at. Who are we? Who are you? And what am I? And how do I act in moments of distress?
Because here's the thing, and this fascinated me. You said it's not fear, really. It's not necessarily fear. There's something else going on. And in that sense, you, as you write in the book, you have to examine the relationship between perpetrators and victims and bystanders. So it's not just that impulse for self-preservation. It's not just fear. It's how you see the victim?
Absolutely. And that, I think, goes exactly to what my parents, in terms of articulating their quote-unquote experience with the bystander,
yeah.
That the bystander, my parents were the other, a person who's status-less.
Yep. But it's interesting to hear your father, or at least read about your father, talking to you about this, he almost gave them a break because
he did.
He said, look, we were Jews. We were the enemy. Why would I expect them to have any obligation to me or do anything for me?
So this is very interesting. 15 years ago, the Hungarian Catholic Church decided that the time has come to do a mea culpa on their role in the Holocaust, and they did this major conference under the auspices of the Vatican, a 2 or 3 day conference, and they chose my father to be the keynote speaker, which is an extraordinary event. I didn't know about it. My mother goes to Budapest with him, doesn't go to hear his lecture at all. The talk was found for me online. I never knew about it. Was found for me by a researcher who's coming to the symposium on Friday, Dr. Victoria Barnett. She finds it online. She doesn't know who I am. She calls me. She says, are you Shawnee Giora's son? I said, I am. She said, do you know about this talk? I said, no, I know nothing about this. They translated for me, and it's an extraordinary – not because it's my dad. It was an extraordinary lecture, I mean, at the point of evil. I mean, in Budapest, right? All that, the Catholic Church. Not once does he mention the word Holocaust. He talks about reconciliation. My mother, by the way, says that if he had given the talk 30 years before that, it would have been a very different talk, which is also interesting. While writing the book, my father became, unfortunately, cognitively very impaired. There was no real conversation with him, except for 3 days in June 2 years ago when, for reasons I'm not a scientist, all the wires reconnected for 3 days. And for 3 days, I interviewed him while writing the book. And that's you're absolutely right. I would say, using expression in Hebrew, he gave the bystander a pass. He said, you didn't owe me any duty. That said, he mimicked with his arm that they would extend their arm, offering him water, and then retract the arm. That's taunting, right? I mean, I'm offering you because I know you need it and taking it back. He had always told me that when he was freed by Tito's partisans in Serbia, that he found a ride in a Russian jeep from Serbia to Sofia in Bulgaria. While writing the book, I met with a Hungarian researcher who's wrote a book about the camp my father was in, and he asked me, what do you know about your father's escape? And I told him, you know, Tito, jeep, Bulgaria, easy ride. He said, it's a lovely story. There's not a bit of truth to it. He said, here's the story. Your father indeed was freed by Tito's partisans on a death march, and that your father led 4 other people on a 136-kilometer hike through the Carpathian Mountains, no compass, no water, no food, no clothes, nothing. Through village after village after village, nobody offering anything. You could only walk at night because you were afraid of walking in the day because you didn't know who the hell was in the neighborhood, right? Yeah. What's interesting is I remember as a child I would say to my dad, you know, everybody else's father does sports and golf and tennis and that, and you're the only one who doesn't do anything. And my father, who never yelled at me, would look at me and say, I survived the Holocaust. Don't you think that's enough? Yeah. And what's extraordinary is in spite of all that, at the age of 86 to 90, he bore no anger at those who did not offer him assistance. I find that to be remarkable.
But how would he have reacted 30 years before then?
Angry.
Yeah. Which tells you what?
Well, before I answer that, I'll tell you, my mother, if you were to interview, my mother's 85, lives in Jerusalem, healthier than the two of us combined. My mother's all about pointing the finger.
Is that right?
Still.
What's the difference?
Different. You and I have different DNA, you know? What caused my father to have this shift? You know, I don't know. He's not alive. I can't ask him. But when he gave this extraordinary talk under the auspices of the Vatican in Budapest, not mentioning the word Holocaust, and talking about reconciliation amongst Jews and Gentiles, it is not because it's my dad. The talk is so extraordinary, we actually turned it into a book honoring my father. I don't know. On the other hand, when I think about my inaction in Ann Arbor when the college student attacks the homeless, I don't forgive myself. I mean, there was a homeless guy being assaulted by, you know, a college kid who was assaulting him. And that for me is just, I walked away because I want, you know, I need to get to the game on time. And this was an inconvenience. And, you know, the game starts and I got to be there for the maize and blue. And in terms of, you know, how I balance and cost benefit, I absolutely made the wrong decision, without a doubt. By the way, I would prosecute myself.
Yeah. Yeah, you would have been complicit.
Oh, absolutely.
It's interesting. It's like you've got these two parts of you that are in conflict. You've got mom's impulse to point the finger and dad's impulse to just like, let's let this go.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, as an only child, I guess I got 50% of him and 50% of her. I don't know.
Is it the mom part that wrote the book? You know, that said, no, let's charge them with a crime.
Maybe, but it was also, I think that's an interesting way of looking at it. But it was clearly, and I take you back to the running, mm-hmm. and an effort to understand. I'm not a psychologist, right? He was. I'm not. Yeah. You can't really understand who you are without understanding where you come from. And I decided I might as well go figure out where I come from, but through the lens of the law. All right, I'm not a moralist. I'm not a historian. But what made the book complicated to write. There are multiple voices in the book, right? There are different parts to the book. There's the personal. There's the Giora family story. There's obviously the drowning. There's the Holocaust history, because you can't write about the Holocaust without writing about the history of the Holocaust. Yeah. There's the legal question, and then there is trying to convince the reader that this is a legal question and not a moral question.
But before we head to a break, I want to have you tell one more story. And this, to me, may have been the most difficult to read. The experience of your mother and your grandmother being expecting themselves to be executed up against a wall. And you went looking for that wall.
I did.
Would you just tell that story first, if
sure,
you would?
Sure, absolutely.
It's horrible.
It is a horrible story. When my grandmother died in February of 1980, my mother wrote an article that was published by the Jewish publication.
Hold on one second. You didn't know anything about the story at
no,
the time?
Okay. No. Published by the Jewish journal, Forward. I read it. I said, oh, my God, right? I mean, wow. In which my mother very graphically, my mother spares the reader nothing. And I put it in the book in its entirety, spares the reader nothing when she's 12 years old. My mother's the, if you will, the Hungarian version of Anne Frank, hiding in the attic. And the knock comes in the door and all the yelling and screaming. And because the Germans had come to Budapest in March of 1944, so this is thereafter. And they obviously had been ratted out, right? Somebody had snitched on them. Yep. And they're taken down to the wall to be shot. And at the last moment, Jewish partisans who were wearing uniforms of the Arrow Cross, the Nazi collaborators the Hungarian collaborators with the Nazis in Hungary, were frantically roaming the streets of Budapest to save Jews at the last moment. And what they really did is they fooled the Arrow Cross, because they would say to the Arrow Cross, leave them to us. Right, the Jews. And that's how my mother was saved. When I went to Budapest last summer, I went.
Wait. I just have to have you say something about this story. Basically, your grandmother says to your mother, we're going to get shot. When we do, I'm going to try to fall.
You fall first, I fall on top of you.
I'll fall on top of you.
Yes.
And hopefully you'll survive.
That's
and
exactly
then
right.
Stay there for a while. I mean, it's a horrible story. And then you'll get up, I'll be dead, and then try to run for help.
My grandmother, by the way, my mother is also an only child. My grandmother, in the moment of unimaginable, was as rational can be rational.
Yeah.
And she wore, on the one hand, a clear parental hat. On the other hand, a very clear A to B to C. This is how you're going. I'm going to die in a minute.
Yeah.
But I'm going to save you. But there was, and the way my mother wrote about it and the way she talks about it, there was no emotion.
Yeah.
My grandmother was, I think, much like my mother. I mean, these are two seriously tough people, right? You have to be. Clear-minded as clear-minded can be, and she told my mother exactly how she's going to save her. Now, fortunately, the shots were not fired, but you're absolutely right. She gave, I don't know any other way to put it, clear instructions, directions, how to fall. I'll fall on top of you. You'll lay here for a while with all the horror of that, with lots of dead people around you, and then you will, you know, sneak off. So when I was in Budapest last June, I found the courtyard. Unfortunately, my mom doesn't remember which wall was right wall, because I wanted to, you know, find the wall. But you stand, whether you – so I decided it'll be this wall, right? I decided. It is one of those moments in life that is beyond overwhelming. There's really not much you can say after standing there. And there were a number of points like that while writing the book of where you confront evil. I mean, as evil can be evil. That was one moment that it literally is overwhelming. I mean, there's nothing you can say. The other such moment is when I went to outside Berlin is the Wannsee Villa where the Final Solution was decided upon. I had read, I never say you read everything, but I had read a lot about it. I've become very good friends with the director of the Wannsee Conference Center, who's been incredibly gracious. As a matter of fact, the picture on the cover of the book, he arranged for it too. Incredibly gracious of him. And I had read enough to know exactly where Eichmann and Heydrich had sat when they decided on the Final Solution. And then Dr. Bosch helped me understand where they then had cognac and cigars after their hour-and-a-half meeting. And I made myself stand there, and because for me it was at that place, and that spot physically, where the fate of my grandparents was determined. They were murdered in Auschwitz, but the decision to murder them was made by them sitting there while they were having their cognac and cigars. That for me was an overwhelming experience in terms of confronting evil. And the third, obviously, is I spent a day in my father's hometown. I hired a Hungarian genealogist. We were able to find my dad's house. And then he arranged for me to meet with a woman who's my age, whose parents were deported with my grandparents, who were able to – she was able – because her mother had told her enough. Her mother told her, unlike my dad, right? She was able to reconstruct for me my grandparents, my grandparents got from house to train station, step by step by step by step. I made myself go to the train station, and I made myself stand on the platform. It's a small town in eastern Hungary. The trains of Hungary in 2017 look like the trains of Hungary of 1944. And while you can't make this up, we're standing on the platform, the genealogist and I, and you know the trains are coming at you, and you can literally take yourself back. I mean, you know, multiple things running through your mind. Those three moments were, I don't know if brutal is a good word. Let's go with overwhelming and how much emotion it just puts you right back. Because, you know, it's my mom at the killing wall. It's my grandparents whose fate is being determined at Wannsee. And it's my grandparents being deported.
Amos Giora is with us, law professor at the University of Utah. His book is called The Crime of Complicity. On Friday, there's going to be a symposium at the S.J. Quinney College of Law on the campus here. It's focused on the bystander dilemma, the Holocaust, war crimes, and sexual assault. The event is free, open to the public. You can get the particulars on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a quick break and then come back for some final thoughts. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with Professor Amos Giora. We're talking about his new book, The Crime of Complicity, The Bystander in the Holocaust. So I wanted to ask you, you say the book began as this exploration of a legal question, and then it changed. You say as the journey went from, you know, from the abstract to the personal, the objective legal analysis took on a different tone. In what way?
So the book, as I mentioned to you earlier, went through multiple iterations. It began as a law book and then became a personal book. And at the end, I would like to think that at the end of the final product, but I leave that to the reader, has multiple different voices, multiple voices, the personal and the legal question, which I think is essential to discuss, and that is whether or not the bystander is legally culpable.
Yeah.
If the reader agrees with me or not, I leave to the reader. My one hope is that at least this book will engender conversation about what's called the re-articulation of duty owed. And if whatever the reader decides, you know, I leave to the reader. But for me, what's really important is, again, I told you I don't like the term, using the Holocaust and then taking sexual assaults today, at least forcing the reader to ask himself or herself, what's the legal duty the bystander owes to the victim? And I look at that through the lens of the law while working in the personal. Somebody who read the book told me that the book agitates. And I thought to myself, you know, I take that to be a compliment because if it agitates, at least it makes you think. One of the reviewers emailed me a very nice after reviewing the book, told me that it's a challenge. And I said, that's fine. I mean, I accept a challenge. I mean, I accept that it's a challenge. Mm-hmm. It's not an easy read. But I think there's a really important – I'd like to think that there's a really important legal question here about duty owed. And if the book facilitates conversation about that, discussion about that, from my perspective as someone who invested 4 years in this thing, as we say in Hebrew, Dayenu, that would meet my – that would be sufficient for me. And what's interesting, if I can just mention this, that the symposium, which will be held this Friday at the law school, there's been delighted to see how much interest there has been in terms of people who want to come and participate and hear the three panels, which tells me that there's the bystander question evidently is incredibly relevant to society today.
Well, especially if it's not just an abstract idea, not just an ethical, moral question. If you're imposing some sort of legal crime into the picture, I think it makes people think differently about it.
I would like to think so. And there are three panels on Friday, the symposium. There's one about the bystander in the Holocaust, bystander in war crimes, and bystander in sexual assaults. The keynote speaker is Professor Jeremy Waldron from New York University. And I think you're right. It's not abstract. It's real. Sexual assaults, tragically, are real. There's nothing abstract about that. The Holocaust, there's nothing abstract about that. And war crimes, just turn on your TV and watch Aleppo, right? And if – again, from my perspective, having obviously invested an enormous amount into this, if the book at least enables, facilitates, cajoles, you know, nudges people into asking that question, from my perspective, that's the best I could hope for.
Amos Giora. Teaches law at the University of Utah, S.J. Quinney College of Law's book is The Crime of Complicity, The Bystander in the Holocaust. As he mentioned, on Friday there's a symposium at the College of Law. You can get the particulars on our website, radiowest.org. Professor, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Our thanks to our intern, David Boyle, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.